From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. Hi, I'm Bob Pavlovich. On today's show, coastal reporter Hallie Parker will bring us up to date on the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion Project. Construction has ground to a halt as the project faces a court challenge. What the University of New Orleans archaeologists are finding under the St. Louis Cathedral, we'll find out from the leader of the university's quick response team. But first, it's Thursday, and that means it's time to catch up on politics with the Times-Picayune, The Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Stephanie Grace. Steph, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Governor Jeff Landry's been waiting in a New Orleans matter since he's taken office, and today we're seeing another sign of that. The first meeting of the task force he appointed to look at the issues of the Sewerage and Water Board. So, what's the backstory here?
Well, the first thing to know is that the Sewage and Water Board is kind of this weird, unique concoction. It's a state agency that is basically run by the mayor and city appointees, but it's also outside of city government. So some changes that you'd think could be made at the city level have to go through the legislature and the governor. And, you know, there are a lot of hands over it, and it gets to be kind of cumbersome and confusing. Also, as everybody knows, there are a lot of problems at the Sewage and Water Board. The streets flood when it rains, the pumps go down, the electrical system's outdated, the billing system is a huge mess. There are civil service restrictions that, you know, people there say keep them from being able to get the best workforce. The pipes are old, there's not enough money, and onward.
And on. So what does Governor Landry want to do about it?
Well, you know, that's the rub. Something. He wants to do something is the best I can tell. If these things could be fixed quickly and easily, they would have been already, because people have been talking about this for a very long time. And to be fair to the Sewage and Water Board, they are working on a number of these fronts. They're installing smart meters, but that's going to take a few years. That should help with the billing problems. They're building a new power station to keep the pumps working, but that's also in progress. But Landry and his point people hear the complaints, just like everybody does, and they want to show that they're on it. So this task force is headed by a guy named Paul Rainwater, kind of a great name for this position.
It's very apt.
Very apt. He actually is he's a lobbyist. He's the city's lobbyist. He's a former administration official with Bobby Jindal, ran the Louisiana Recovery Authority after Katrina. And he was briefly over the Sewage and Water Board when Mitch Landry was mayor. So he's familiar with it. But the task force there's one Sewage and Water Board kind of citizen member, but no city officials, no Sewage and Water Board officials. So that has led to some complaints. Its assignment is to address things like billing and governance structure in, get this, 30 days. So there are two additional hearings scheduled. Then they are supposed to report back to the governor. So we'll see what they do.
So since this is a state-created entity, are we looking at a possible state takeover?
You know, I think there are fears of that, but I really don't see that happening. Basically, because why would the governor want to take responsibility for something that is perennially problematic?
Yeah.
I do think he wants to show action, though. And, you know, so again, we'll see what that means. It's interesting because the city council has also been all over this, and they've been wanting to show action and have passed a number of reforms, and they've reacted pretty defensively to this move. Oliver Thomas, who chairs the council committee that oversees public works, said it's, you know, typical, a Republican governor trying to impose his will on the Democratic city. And a number of council members noted, you know, really quite testily that they've passed their own reforms and they expect the water board to be pursuing those, despite what the governor does. And then the mayor is, you know, the mayor is the president of the Sewage and Water Board, and she hasn't been entirely negative. You know, she is trying to work with Landry where she can. And she did kind of reiterate that, you know, yeah, the governance structure is unworkable.
And the mayor's also asked the Sewage and Water Board for a report by the end of the month as well.
The water board itself is answering to all these different masters, even in this kind of, you know, task force, report process.
Yeah. So. Well, we've also got some elections coming up March 23rd, early voting starting Saturday. What tops the local ballot?
Well, the big local race in the New Orleans area is a special election for district attorney in the 22nd JDC that includes St. Tammany Parish and also Washington Parish. And this is to finish out the unexpired term of Warren Montgomery, who died late last year after a long bout with cancer. his interim DA, his former top aide, Colin Sims, who was criminal chief under Montgomery, is on the ballot. He has been acting as interim DA. And his opponent is Vincent Wynn, who actually lost to Montgomery last time around. Wynn worked for Montgomery's predecessor, Walter Reed, who you'll remember wound up going to federal prison. So that's been an issue in the race. It's been a little bit of a proxy war between Montgomery forces and Reed forces. Although I should note that Wynn did not involved in anything having to do with that case.
And in the minute or so we've got left, we've got a presidential primary as well, correct?
Such as it is, I think we've have our candidates, but people can still, the primary is still on the ballot for Democrats and Republicans who want to vote. The more interesting thing on these party ballots is votes for state central committee at the kind of legislative district level. And particularly on the Democratic side, there's a lot of activity, a lot of energy there because there's a ton of dissatisfaction in the ranks over the party's leadership and really the dreadful showing in last year's state elections. And the chair, Katie Bernhardt, who is, going to face some very stiff opposition if she wants to keep that job. So there's really a move by progressives to capture a lot of these local offices and bring new and more aggressive leadership. And I should add that, these unlike most Louisiana elections, and I know we have changes coming up in later, but right now you can only vote in the party elections if you are registered as a Democrat or a Republican. So if you are not registered in a party, you are out of luck this time.
The Times-Picayune, the Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Stephanie Grace. Steph, again, thanks for being here.
Okay, thank you.
From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Bob Pavlovich. The loss of protective marsh along the coast of Louisiana continues, but an effort to help slow that loss broke ground last August. The Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion Project is seen as an answer to a part of this problem. But a lawsuit filed by Plaquemines Parish in late February against the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority has brought that project to a halt. Joining us to bring us up to date is our coastal reporter, Hallie Parker. Hallie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Can you get us all on the same page, Hallie? What is this project and why is it so important?
So the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion has been in talks for over 30 years now. It's a $3 billion project that would basically punch a hole in the West Bank of the Mississippi River in Plaquemines Parish near Ironton and Myrtle Grove. And it would make it so muddy water from the Mississippi River would be able to flow down this 2-mile-long concrete channel. It's part of this effort to rebuild some of the land that's been lost in Barataria Bay, as well as maintain other land building projects. Basically, it'll mimic the way the river used to build land before it was levied off. So the mud and sand from the river water will drop out once it enters the bay, pile on top of each other, and eventually build new land. And it's projected to build around 21 square miles of land, the state's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, CPRA, along with dozens of coastal scientists have said that it's the only self-sustaining project in the state's plan to restore the coast. And it's also the only one that has a chance at keeping up with sea level rise. And it's really the first project of its kind.
Ground was broken in August of 2023, but now the construction has stopped. What stopped it? What's the parish's concern?
So last week, Plaquemines Parish ordered all of the work on the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion to stop. And I mean, this project has always been controversial. Even at the groundbreaking last summer, no local Plaquemines Parish officials showed up. So the parish has long opposed this project, and in November, they actually sued the state over it. The parish argues that the permitting process was flawed, and it's worried that the influx of water from this diversion will increase the risk of flooding for nearby communities. The bigger argument, is that if flood risk increases by too much, the parish claims that it could get kicked out of the National Flood Insurance Program. Apparently, there were emails between an official with FEMA, with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Plaquemines Parish, and CPRA back in 2022, before the project was greenlit. But FEMA has since said that it doesn't have any concerns with the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion anymore, and that its questions were resolved.
Isn't there another lawsuit involving the parish's oyster fishers? And hasn't an advocacy group joined them in that suit?
Oh, yes. There's lawsuits everywhere. So there's another lawsuit, and this one is federal, and that's in play as well. And that was actually filed within days of the Plaquemines Parish one that happened in the fall. It involves a mix of oyster harvesters, like you mentioned, plus marine animal researchers and an environmental group. They're all suing the Army Corps of Engineers over the sediment diversions permit, plus two other federal agencies. So they argue the benefits of this sediment diversion are unproven and that not enough weight was given to the harm that all of this new fresh water will cause commercial fishers in the area and also dolphins that have moved into the bay as it's grown saltier. So dolphins really can't handle a lot of fresh water, and there's expected to be a big die-off when this project opens. Though the state will be monitoring for dolphin health, and there's also money available to help these fishers adapt.
Some were fearful that the stoppage would see the entire project killed by the new Landry administration. What's the reaction been from the state to this point?
Yeah, so there was some signals of openness to maybe rethinking or thinking about the project a little bit differently and taking even more of these concerns into consideration. But last week, the state issued a very strong statement reasserting that even with this change in leadership and administration, they are very committed to seeing this project move forward.
We're talking with coastal reporter Hallie Parker about the halting of the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion Project near Ironton, Louisiana, in Plaquemines Parish. Hallie, give us a little context, a thumbnail, if you will, about coastal land loss, and what does a big delay in this project mean for the crisis?
Yes, so that's a really good question. And I mean, so far we've already seen 430 square miles of land lost in the Barataria Basin, which is an astronomical amount that we're seeing affect the area. This project was always going to take a long time. It's supposed to take at least 5 years to construct. And so the longer that we see this delay last, that just pushes out that timeline for getting this operating even farther back. I will say there are going to be other marsh creation projects happening even while we're waiting on the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion to open. So it will just mean that we're not going to see this larger project that is, again, a little bit different from regular marsh creation projects. It's one that will actually be self-sustaining. We won't have that going for even longer now.
Are there any other projects that are underway that could face similar delays and court challenges like this?
Yeah, it's funny you ask that because there's already another sediment diversion project that was proposed and is still being considered. It's called the Mid-Breton sediment diversion, and it's a little bit farther upriver from the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. And that one is not nearly as far along as the Mid-Barataria, and it's already facing legal challenges from Mississippi. So it's unclear if that one will move forward or get off the ground. There's also such limited funding available, even beyond lawsuits, that it's difficult to imagine more sediment diversions coming online anytime soon.
There are those who say the creators of the MBSD project considered only financial and environmental issues, that the social identities and the generations of shrimpers and oyster fishers and others who have relied on the Gulf fisheries for their way of life, that it was not adequately considered. In your reading of the documents related to this, what did you find?
Well, those arguments are not new at all. I would definitely say there were hundreds of public comments submitted, thousands of public comments submitted regarding this issue. And from my own reporting experiences, I've found that oyster fishers, shrimpers, people in the commercial fishing industry have really never felt fully heard by CPRA, by the state as they've gone through this process. The state in the past had downplayed some of the effects that the fishers might have seen. But in the past few years, they've been very clear about what a shock to the system this project really will be. When it comes to oysters, you know, they can't swim around, they can't move when a lot of fresh water comes and inundates where their beds are. So those beds will be gone. Shrimp will have to move because they can't handle that high of fresh water. So these are very real challenges that these fishers are facing. But to say that their concerns weren't adequately considered, I wouldn't say is necessarily true. And I don't think the state would say is true. But it will be up to the courts to decide.
So where does it go from here? Any court dates been set?
Yes. So there was actually a hearing earlier today in Point Allahatch, where the CPRA argued the merits of staying the case. And when it comes to this stop work order, it's unclear how long Plaquemines Parish will keep that in place. It's possible that it will stay in place until its lawsuit is complete.
Our coastal reporter, Hallie Parker, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bob.
From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Bob Pavlovich. University of New Orleans archaeology students are inside St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans, taking advantage of an opportunity. That opportunity comes in the guise of a planned renovation. Contractors discovered that the 1849 Cathedral Foundation wasn't the only one there. Leading the UNO archaeology students is Ryan Gray, anthropology professor and New Orleans urban historical archaeologist. Thank you for taking time out of the dig to speak with us, Ryan.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being with you.
What's it like digging and exploring a 300-year-old foundation?
Well, you know, here, right in the middle of the French Quarter, it was really a unique experience, really unique opportunity. You know, we're at the very heart of the city, but also we're constantly engaging with the public here because there are hundreds of people stopping by the site every day, asking about what we're doing, what we're finding. So there's this back and forth every moment between the actual task of excavation and documentation and recovering artifacts and all these things, but also talking with people and really explaining and interpreting what we're doing. It really is a great opportunity.
So you are literally peeling back layers of American, French, and Native American life.
Yes. You know, what we find is when you have a major structure like this that has been in place for so long, it preserves all of those earlier layers really well. And after the current version of the cathedral was completed around 1851, you know, little beneath it has been disturbed. So there are layers from the 1794 version of the cathedral. There are layers from the 1724 church that burned in the 1788 fire and all sorts of renovations that happened with it. And then layers going back to, you know, the first years after the city was founded.
What have you and your students been able to determine there?
You know, one of the things that we won't know until later is really what all is in some of those earlier layers, because they're so messy and mucky that we're taking soil samples off-site to process through fine mesh to make sure that we're not missing tiny artifacts like beads and fish bones and fish scales and things like that that are difficult to see in really wet and mucky soils. But already we know that there is ample evidence of the first occupation era associated with that early version of the church. There are different periods of activity represented all around. This has been a hub of activity for a long time. And we're going to, each of those layers that we're peeling back is a social history of the city. It'll take a while to really be able to interpret it, but we hope we can make that interpretation part of the plans for whatever they eventually do with the cathedral and its restoration.
What sort of artifacts have you been able to find so far?
There's always things like bits of pottery, English pottery, French pottery, Spanish and Mexican pottery, and indigenous pottery once we get into those earliest layers. But then the things that are most evocative to people are often those things that are more unusual. You know, we found bits of a bone or ivory folding fan, like someone would use to fan themselves in a hot church on a Sunday during Mass. We found bits of straight pins, a bit of a religious metal, bits of smoking pipes and animal bones that speak to what people were eating at different periods of time.
You mentioned straight pins.
Yeah, that was one of the things that we've kind of remarked upon that are particularly interesting here. And when we looked at the historic documents that are about the first version of the church, one of the things that stuck out to me right away in the descriptions of it was that the windows, there wasn't initially window pane glass to glaze the windows. And so they stretched pieces of thin fabric over the windows very tightly to let light through, but still have some measure of protection.
Hmm.
And so we think that it's likely that those straight pins in the earliest levels reflect that period before the window pane glass arrived on site. And then later, we actually start, in those layers above, we actually start binding the window pane glass, stained glass that we would associate with the windows of the church and cathedral in later years. So it's a nice temporal marker. I should mention that, you know, as part of this, we're working with teams of contractors and architects and cathedral staff who are doing this project as part of the restoration. So our excavation sites are chosen not based on where we think that we're going to find the most necessarily, but they're selected based on the needs of the restoration. Mm-hmm. To see the conditions of the footings in different particular spots. That's the reason that this is happening. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't lightly go in and remove 150-year-old layers of floor and slab.
We're speaking with Ryan Gray, anthropology professor and urban historical archaeologist at the University of New Orleans, about his and his students' work at St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans. Will the dig there continue? Will there be more opportunities to explore beneath the cathedral?
I think that once we complete the excavation we're working on right now, then that's going to wrap up everything for now. After that, it will really be up to the people working on restoration. If there's a need to open up more space beneath the cathedral, I think we've been able to document so much interesting information that otherwise would be lost, that I think everyone understands the importance of doing this in an archaeological manner, because there really is such a lot here to learn still. You know, there are some things that are documented in historical sources and maps, but there are other parts of just the everyday experience, the everyday use and life of the building and the sacred space that otherwise you really just can't get to.
Ryan, you and your students are sort of an archaeological quick response team in this situation. You got the call and you were there. Pretty accurate?
That's pretty accurate. You know, there's really no one else in the city who does what we do and who can respond quickly in cases like this. There are private archaeology companies who do compliance-based work. They're often engaged in projects and don't have time and schedules to do kind of pro bono projects like this. Yeah, we try to serve that purpose for the city. When people have some kind of question about what they're finding as they work on a house, as they get ready to do some kind of building project, you know, they can call on us and we'll do our best to help and to make recommendations for how to preserve and document what's there. This happens to be a particularly high-profile version of that, but we do that all over the city all the time, and I think we are serving an integral function as part of a public-serving urban institution like UNO to be able to do that all over the city.
Ryan Gray, anthropology professor and urban historical archaeologist. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being with you.
From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Bob Pavlovich. Thanks to our guests, Stephanie Grace, the Times-Picayune, The Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Hallie Parker, our coastal reporter, and Dr. Ryan Gray, anthropology professor and New Orleans urban historical archaeologist at the University of New Orleans. Our producers are Matt Bloom, Adam Voss, and Aubrey Procell. Our engineer, Garrett Pittman. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. on this station. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bob Pavlovich. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience. More at rouses.com, with additional support from Southern Strategy Group.